Investor interest in hedge funds continues to grow. Institutional investors poured nearly $25 billion into the sector in the second quarter this year, the most since 2014. That's according to the latest hedge fund research report.
It's getting tougher recruiting the right talent. It's not uncommon for hedge funds these days to even get into bidding wars. Some companies, like Point72, pay tens of millions of dollars to secure the people they want.
You're listening to Asia Centric from Bloomberg Intelligence. I'm John Lee in Hong Kong.
I'm Katja Dmitrieva, also in Hong Kong.
And today we're discussing the hedge fund industry, strategy and talent with Jay Luo, president of Diamond Asia Capital, a regionally focused alternative investment manager with about $5 billion in assets. He also previously managed SAC's activities in Asia. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Jay, Diamond started off as a macro hedge fund, but your fund transitioned more towards a multi-manager platform, i.e. a pod shop. Why did you make that transition?
When Danny and I came together in 2012, it was a vision to build what we have today. In a way, many of our investors and a lot of old friend of mine has been sharing with us and say, what took you guys so long? So if I give you a little history back, right? I mean, I worked for SAC Capital. I worked for Steve Cohen for 10 years, my first 5 years at a US headquarter. And in 2007, he sent me to Asia. You know, back then, Asia did not have these pod shops. In fact, none of the large competitors that you'll be familiar with were established in Asia at the time. So in the next 5 years, I was fortunate enough that Steve gave me sufficient runway to have figured it out. You know, in 2012, by the time I left SAC to join Diamond, I gave back a program. I believe it was 14 different portfolio manager teams. That would have been the first pod shop structure that was operating at scale in Asia. So Danny started Diamond in 2008 as a single CIO macro fund, as you mentioned. By 2012, Diamond's macro fund was at $2.5 billion, which back in 2012 was a very large size. And he and I have been talking for a while. I got a call from him, basically said, look, you know, how come all of the large institutionalized hedge funds, alternative asset platforms, were US firms, where we Asians couldn't do it? So I bought into that pitch to come over and, you know, try to join force, bring my equity set of knowledge. So, you know, collectively going towards building this multi-strategy, multi-PM platform as you have today.
Just for listeners who aren't aware, so pod shops are sort of like a bit of a different structure. So you have teams and each team has sort of a different strategy. Is that right? Is that the right way to look at it?
Yeah, that's the right way to look at it. And, you know, I was fortunate to join the industry. I believe I joined Steve SAC back in 2001. That was the early stage of the hedge funds. I call them the previous generation hedge fund titans. Started to evolve from, in the beginning, most of them were managing money by themselves. And then what's the next thing you do, you start hiring your friends to help you manage money. And at some point, the next step is to just bring in talent, just pure skill-based talent, where you can entrust them, giving them an environment, supplying them with resource, letting them be the ones making the primary investment decisions. And you provide an infrastructure. That's the beginning of the pod shop.
And what are the inherent advantages of a pod shop? Because traditionally, if the public thinks of hedge funds, they probably think of someone like a George Soros or a Julian Robinson who ran Tiger, where they take big concentrated bets on a stock or maybe like, you know, like an asset class or a currency. But pod shops are different. Like, there's little teams. Can you explain why this strategy works?
Right. See, from an investor perspective, and to refer to what I was saying about the first generation of hedge fund titans, when they evolved these pod shops, the most important element is how do you go harvest these uncorrelated skill-based returns at a scale? So from an investor's perspective, when you're invested with a single manager, you are relying on that CIO's his ability to direct you to, say, different asset class. You're relying on George Soros to tell you, this is year we go, you know, pound sterling. The next year we go Japan. On the pod shop, like we have 75 portfolio managers today, they tend to be specialized in their own respective area. We're allowing each one of them to make investment decision completely on their own in their areas of expertise. And because they are structured to be specialized and because they're structured to go for the absolute return, the average correlation of these different return streams are relatively low. In our case, we can achieve a average correlation of under 5%, 0.05. So put on your portfolio construction theory, that's how you get a stability of a return. So from an investor's perspective, the biggest attraction of these pod shops or multi-PM companies is the stability of the return that they are receiving.
And if we talk about Diamond specifically, I mean, there's probably diversity in returns and strategy from these different pods that you have and these 75 different managers. What strategies have been, would you say, the most successful over the past year? Because we've seen a lot of volatility.
Right. So we are structured across both the macro and the equities. Again, you know, when Diamond started, my partner Danny, he started as a macro PM. By the time we combined a macro and equity business together, there was like already 20 different portfolio managers. My background was on equities. I joined Diamond in 2012. And in 2014, Singapore Sovereign Temasek, you know, funded the equity build out of a business. So by the time we combined the fund into the pod shop structure, we already have seven or eight different equity managers. So for us, it's that diversity of the managers across different asset class and across different geographic regions. That's the source of the stability. So for example, last year, half of our return were coming from the equity long short. Last year, the phenomenon last year is that for the first two, three quarters, macro has been a challenging strategy, not just for us, but for our global competitors as well. But because we have the equity piece of it, so equity was powering through, you know, providing the stability of the returns for our macro managers to be patient. This year, the first two, 3 months, the equity has been challenging. Again, it's not us looking across the space as well, but macro was driving the return. So the answer to your question is, we don't know ahead of time which strategy is going to do well, not do well. But the power of having these multiple different strategies uncorrelated is that at any given point, some group of strategies are going to be performing well, giving you the stability that we're producing for the investor.
And could we delve into, just like to get some examples, could we delve into some of the strategies that have worked? Like, we've talked a lot on this show about Pop Mart and the Chinese consumer winning in certain places. You know, did you have like a long on Pop Mart by chance?
The other differentiating thing about a pod shop differentiated from the single CIO funds, like, we rarely talk to the investors about our positions. I'll tell you why, because we do not have significant exposure on a single position. That's where, again, the diversification is about. Are we long in Pop Mart? We are. You know, one of my portfolio manager in one of the investor meetings, my investor asked him, hey, tell me why about this Labubu.
Labubu.
What is about it? I can comfortably tell you, I do not fully understand that thesis myself. However, where the value I'm providing there is then identifying the portfolio manager and being able to say, I entrust this portfolio manager because he's had many years of experience, not just including in Labubu, but investing in some of the other companies. And he's been gone through the ups and downs. Therefore, we were able to invite him to come to manage a slice of a capital and giving him a mandate that as so long as he's within the risk limits, you hear a lot about these pod shops talk about risk limits. So long as he's within these risk limits, that he's fully empowered to make his investment decision, go long Labubu or short Labubu.
Asia Centric is produced by Bloomberg Intelligence, where more than 500 experienced analysts and strategists work around the clock to bring you timely, world-class research. Our coverage spans 200 market indices, currencies, commodities, and industries, as well as over 2,000 equities and credits. To learn more about Bloomberg Intelligence, visit BIGO on the Bloomberg Terminal. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe and share. Jay, your returns have been quite strong this year. Like, I read that your returns year to date up until the end of August is up 12%. So that's outperformed a lot of your global peers. Can you explain why you've been able to, you know, have this outperformance?
When we merged the fund together in 2020, it was actually the onset of COVID. In fact, our fund started trading the very first day after the lockdown of Wuhan. It took a bit longer than we were planning to hire the adequate number of portfolio managers to achieve this level of diversification that I was describing to you about.
So you were hiring during the pandemic, basically.
We learned how to hire during the pandemic. We learned how to hire during the pandemic. This kind of pod structure fund the stability is rooted on the diverse number of teams of portfolio managers. With a bit of a benefit of hindsight, you need about at least 40 portfolio managers to be able to give you this level of stability. Once you achieve this magic number, 40 is my number, maybe other people have a different number, then you're able to fully entrust your portfolio managers for them to make bottom-up decisions. To give an example, Korea, you know, we just came out of a short sales ban, right? We were not at IC level telling our Korean managers what to do during the short sales ban. We were there supporting them because there's an expert, there's a frontline, their decision subject to the risk guideline that we set for them are much better at guiding the portfolio asset allocation decisions than, let's say, Danny Young, my partner CIO, was able to call on the from top-down level. So the performance of this year, in my mind, is really a continuation of the power of the platform. You know, we've been pretty steady ever since we crossed that 40 portfolio manager mark. These days, it's pretty hard for me to pinpoint, did we do one trade right? You know, back in the macro days, it was all about Danny making the right call. You know, if we had a fantastic month, fantastic year, it was because Danny got the dollar yen right.
Was there any country or any sector that that has done?
Actually, no. I mean, we've been profitable in every country we're operated in. And every country we are market neutral. We're neutral to the country. We're neutral to the sector. In some of the countries, we're neutral to the factor as well.
Any surprises? Like anything this year that, you know, you're looking at returns or you're looking at performance and you're like, oh, I didn't think that that would do so well.
Any point, there'll be a surprise. Let's say last year, the surprise at the beginning of the year was that China market long short, China alpha suddenly came back in Q1 last year. We did not anticipate that. If you recall 22 and 23, it was pretty miserable years for any China long short manager because it doesn't matter what you do, you always lose money. With a better benefit of hindsight, we now know those were the 2 years where then the global investors were pulling money away. It's like, it doesn't matter how good your company's earnings are, the stock just doesn't go up because someone is just consistent selling pressure. And we did not know that, but it was the first quarter of 2024, we started to see the China non-short managers started to perform. Again, I'm using this story to emphasize the point I brought up earlier, is that today, our job as an investment committee, as an exco, is not about go picking which opportunity is going to be right for the next month or next quarter. Our job is to go pick the individual, to pick the talent, to then invite a talent to come to say, come to work for us. You don't need to run your own hedge fund. We'll provide you everything you need, capital, infrastructure, corporate access, AI tools. So you focus on do what you're good at. That's really the source of it. And any point is always a surprise. What's a surprise this year? The fundamental long short equity as a category was struggling for the first 3 months. Again, I don't think we're the only one. And it was kind of understandable because you have President Trump imposing tariff on friends and foe, and a lot of binary situations. So as an equity investor, it's very difficult to place your bet in this binary situation. What we did not know was that the low point of the equity long-short performance was the day after the announcement of the Liberation Day. It was like, ooh, after Liberation Day announcement, all of a sudden all the bad news start in and markets start to behave rationally. What I want to emphasize is we did not know that. I'm only telling you this with after effect of looking at a performance and say, wow, that's interesting. That was a low point.
Jay, you mentioned that the most important aspect of your job is to find the right talent. Now, there's been a lot of media reports that, you know, hedge funds are in a battle or a war to recruit the right talent. Some of the large pod shops like Millennium, Citadel, Balyozny, your old firm like Point72, they're paying tens of millions of dollars to get the star trader. How can you manage that? And how difficult is it to compete with these large guys?
It is difficult, but I want to say is in Asia, we're the incumbent. You know, when I first came in Asia in 2007, these pod shops did not exist. I think at the time, Citadel was probably had the largest presence. They were in newspaper front page, taking out a large floor at Cheddar House. My partner Danny was part of that cohort. And in 2008, they pretty much completely retreated. So over the years, in my time on the equity side and Danny's time on the macro side, we were the first group of people in Asia that were hiring portfolio managers, training portfolio managers, and providing environment for them. I would not have dreamed to compete with those large shops in New York or in London. I just don't have the edge. But in Asia, that's our home turf. And for our portfolio managers, I mean, the hiring of talent is also quite different in 2025 versus back in 2007, 2008, when I was hiring for Steve Cohen. Back then, my job was about finding who are these hireable managers are. Who are the managers who has a track record of managing market neutral, be able to manage towards a fairly tight drawdown risk limit that this platform requires, and go explain to them that you don't have to run your own hedge fund. You can join one of these platforms. You'll be highly satisfied. You'll be paid very well. Back then, that was a job. Today is not the case anymore. Today, all the big boys you mentioned are here in Asia. Every good portfolio manager out there, they already know which are the good platforms they want to work with. We keep telling our BD teams, right? For the type of manager we are trying to hire, they are hiring us. It's not we're hiring them. So what that translates to my answer to your question of how do we compete, it's not about go say competing on the terms or competing on the dollars. It's about building the right kind of firm that these people we like to attract, they would like to prefer to work with us as opposed to most of the larger platform as well as other Western firms. So quick question to your answer is about building the right culture where people would like to come to work with us as opposed to larger global platforms.
And how much would you say a portfolio manager in Asia is making these days? You know, because we did see like Point72 had hired someone earlier this year, poached a tech analyst for about $50 million. I mean, I know it's not just about the dollars and cents, but, you know, is there sort of an accepted number that you start at?
Every global platform tells their BD team, business development team, which in our industry, the business development team is a team who's charged to hire people. They're not called HR. They are called a business development team, which shows you in our industry how important we put this talent acquisition as. So in most of global platforms, they instruct their business team to hunt for only the whales. And the whales definition in Asia may have changed in these days. Would say, give or take, you make $100 million P&L every year. And there are not too many teams in Asia who's been able to consistently produce that number. So maybe that gives you a scale. So I do not know where that buyout numbers come from. But yes, we hear large numbers as well. But I'll say like $100 million P&L is still considered a whale in this region today.
And just a follow-up. So you have 75 portfolio managers, you said. Are you looking for more?
Yes, we are. I was asked by one of our investors, how many managers do you want? And why do you need so many more managers? I think the answer to that is that if I go back to why this pod model, again, going back to the last generation, the Steve Cohen's award, how they evolved this model, it was because they need to scale these uncorrelated skill-based return. And there's an important thing about skill-based return is it does not scale very easily. I've personally worked with portfolio managers who are extremely good, extremely consistent, and perhaps making $10 million. And when you give the same manager more capital and try to make him make 20, he's going to falter. So for us, the core of our business is go hiring these best people and try to work with them. We position ourselves not as an employer. We position ourselves as a partner to our portfolio managers to help them grow, to help them scale into larger P&L production. It's like it's their business. That's language we use. It's your business. How do I work together with you to scale your business from 10 million to 20 million to 30 million to 50 million to 100 million? And we do that manager by manager. So that's the reason we're constantly in this market looking and hunting for the very best talent, the very best athlete, and then try to invite them to join our platform, try to grow with them.
Jay, where do you get your talent from? Like, is it other hedge funds? Is it traders on like at investment banks? But, you know, they've been sort of cutting a lot of their trading book over the last few years. Is it like long fund or mutual fund managers?
Maybe Steve is calling you and saying, I got this applicant. Maybe you'd be interested too.
In 2007, in the earlier days, a lot of these talent were from the investment banks. But as you know, post-GFC, most of investment banks have reduced their risk-taking activity. So that school of training, unfortunately, has been shut down. I recall I think 2015, maybe it was the last year, one of these large global competitors that you mentioned previously, they took out a very large prop desk in Japan. That was the last large prop desk acquisition I could think of. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So today, half our hires, about 50% of our hires, a bit more, are from these other platforms. Other platform has now become these new training schools. So in the pursuit of these larger platforms in Asia for these big whales, and when because there was a lack of whales, so what they do is once they hire someone who has potential, then they throw enormous number of resources to this prospective whale and help the individual grow into a whale. In the process, a lot of newer people get trained in the process, and some make it, some not make it. Sometimes a brilliant junior felt his potential would be capped by the senior portfolio manager and choose to leave. Those were the opportunities we have. And then there's the other half of hiring are from these Asia multi-strats. So people tend to use multi-strat and a multi-PM pod shop a bit interchangeably. The key difference to me is that in our type of multi-PM model, PM is at the center of our activity. All of the investment decisions are made by the portfolio managers versus most of the traditional Asia's multi-strats. There's still the single CIO model. So if you are a portfolio manager working at these multi-strat, you have a CIO boss who's going to tell you, why are you so long on China? I'm bearish on China. So these groups collectively tends to be a training shop where their best portfolio manager at some stage when they're mature, they tend to want to leave to have their own portfolio. It's either us or one of those global platforms.
So let's say that there's someone out there that you really want. You know, you have your meeting and all of the team decides that we want this guy or we want this girl. Can you tell me a bit about, you know, just I'm personally curious, what is the courting process for this individual? Is it simply, you know, you reach out on LinkedIn or you send them an email, or is it something a bit more intricate? Like, I imagine these people are very busy. You also probably want to stand out, you know, as a company. So how do you kind of go about that?
The courting process probably has started two to three years ago.
Oh, wow.
Oh, well, okay.
The tier one players in this platform business have their in-house business development team. These tends to be individuals who are fairly experienced, fairly senior. A lot of them have previously came from a buy side, came from sell side. They're able to have this dialogue with portfolio managers, risk takers, even when the risk manager is not looking for a job. So our philosophy is that we're not looking for people who's looking for a job. If I just do that, I can sit here all day long, wait for the resume to show up. And unfortunately, there's a negative selection process in there because better individuals, they're not looking for a job. They're never looking for a job. So it's a research-driven reverse process of figuring out who is good in which sector and systematically go court, go introduce ourselves to the individual before the individual is looking for a job.
How do you introduce yourself? Dinner? Champagne? Sushi?
A lot of coffee and used to be a lot of drinks too. I don't do drinks anymore, but I know my teams do. It's about marketing your firm. It's about sharing with the prospective candidate. You believe one day you may want to work together. What is our proposition? You know, the question you asked me earlier, why Diamond? You know, if one day you were getting a offer from Diamond and one from Point 72, from Millennium, from Citadel, why we think you should seriously consider Diamond despite our fund is 3.5 billion and their fund is 60 billion. It's about that process. That process does not happen after the candidate says, I'm looking for a job. So this is the first part of the process is we call the business development process. It's kind of a dating process that you know, we're introducing ourselves to the candidate, and through the process, we're understanding the candidate of what is this person's edge? What does it care for? What is the career plan? It's a lengthy process. Sometimes it goes on for years. And then at some point, something happens. In our industry, something always tend to happen. It can be many things. We call it a catalyst. So the candidate say, I'm ready to move. And he's going to reach out to a few people that he felt comfortable with in this multi-year dating process and say, I'm ready to move. I'd like to come into an interview process. Then we switch on the interview process. I think every firm does it a bit differently. This is where you seriously go down an interview. We scrutinize number, we talk about winners and losers, et cetera. Then we make a decision, we really would like to work with this individual and let's see if we can cut a contract.
How many more of those additions could we see this year? Potentially.
anywhere between probably 10 to 20.
Oh, adding 10 to 20 more portfolio managers.
Yeah. I mean, this industry, unfortunately, I thought you were already going to ask me. It's a performance-driven industry, which means that despite our best intent, there's going to be a number of managers at any given year who's going to leave the platform.
Right.
It's the necessary nature of a performance business. We speak of that we're running a high-performance sports team. We're inviting all the team members to come to play. Everyone come to play for the team. And we do our job to support everyone and make sure everyone's well taken care of. But it's your job to perform for the team. At some junction, at some point, when you're not performing anymore, you may have to be asked to leave the team. So there's that attrition of a manager as well. Again, not us, but this is across all the platform models.
We were talking about that yesterday, actually.
Yeah, look, I love this analogy of, you know, comparing a hedge fund manager to a sports star. And interestingly, the co-founder, Danny Jung, stepped back and he became a coach. That's obviously got like a sports analogy. Can you tell us what a coach does in hedge funds?
So we have today 75 portfolio managers. That's 75 partners we have. That's 75 individuals who, by virtue of them being in the seat, have done something fairly fantastic and has achieved quite a bit in their career. That's why we invited them to them. Every single one of them has their own career development plan. And we've positioned ourselves, say, we're going to be your partner. We're going to help you. We're going to help you get into new markets. We're going to help you hire PMs. We're going to help you get through this mental hurdle of like, every time you have more capital, your performance starts to drop. What's going on? That by itself is a full-time job.
Right.
And we're going to have to also defend our best people. When our competitors come to say, you should come to join us. I'm going to give you this package, you know. All those add up to a full-time job.
Okay, like the sports industry, is there a period where you just become too old to be a hedge fund manager? Do they have expiry dates? Because if you think of like, for example, like the NBA, if you've got a good career, you've got a 15-year career. What's it like in, you know, being a hedge fund manager in a pod shop?
We actually done a study, the correlation between age of a portfolio manager and performance. Now, we know our larger global competitors also have done that. But of course, no one wants to talk about it. What we actually conclude is not the age. We use a phrase called vintage. It's like when you became a portfolio manager, the first few years you were in industry, your first mentor, your second mentor, your third mentor, someone taught you how to invest. There was a particular setting. It could be maybe it was the environment on the equity side. Maybe that was the environment that was China was going through hyper growth phase. All you needed to do is to identify the right sector and the best company within the sector would be making money. And then that regime will shift, will change. And nowadays, China is not a single one-way growth market anymore, a lot more nuance. So some of the managers are able to make that through that transition, others could not. So this is a vintage concept that we believe that for some managers, there's no definitive number of years, but for some managers, when the market regime shift, when the environment where they were trained to make money changed, some of them may not be able to adapt. Then that's our shelf life.
What else was in the survey? Were there any other interesting findings?
If you were to survey all of the population of the portfolio manager across all of the industry, if you're able to have that data, you probably find most of the managers fall into the relatively younger bracket, maybe the mid-30s to mid-40s. You probably see the most of that. So that's your starting observation. So that then begs the question of why. Is it age? Is it like the sports? Like past some stage, past some age, you just, maybe your brain doesn't work as fast anymore. Yeah. Or maybe we speculated maybe it was the hunger level. Maybe when you're younger, you're just more hungry. And when you still have children, when you made money already, you're no longer. But then we look at some of the very successful managers. They don't need money anymore. They still work the same part. They just like it. So what we end up concluding, it's not age. It's not the money factor. It's not a burnout. It is the vintage that's most important. Mm.
Jay, you started this career in the early 2000s. What's the big difference between the attributes of a successful hedge fund manager now versus, say, like 2008 or 2005?
I think specifically for Asia, before Asia financial crisis, Asia was by and large an emerging market, that the stock price was largely driven by the flows coming from US, coming from London. Those are the flows typically were directed by a discretionary fundamental manager or work for one of the larger global houses. So to be a good Asia portfolio manager, to be a good Asia hedge fund manager, a lot of what you need to do is to be there when that tide started coming and be able to pick the best companies within the sector, within the country where the growth is. And you can largely make it. Hedging was quite challenging at the time. So you can probably be forgiven if you can just lose less money when that tide recedes. Asia's market is very different now in the last 5 or 8 years. You know, like most of our managers I mentioned earlier, today runs market neutral, runs country neutral, runs sector neutral. That was just not possible in 2007, in 2008. If you look at the flow, you know, today the international flow is still important, but equally largely the amount of a domestic participant. Some of these markets, you know, well known in China, you know, still more than 70% of the turnover is still driven by the retail. Korea, this number is roughly similar to here. But if you look at 2007, 2008, Korean retail participation was maybe about 20 to 30%. So you need to be a lot more tuned in into the nuance of what's going on in your local market, which also brings in one important observation I want to mention here, right? I think even in 2012, I recall there was a paper by one of the famous hedge fund consultant, very, very well-known hedge consultant in the industry, making the observation that back then it was still quite popular for the CIO or investment team of an Asian hedge fund to be based in London and to be based in New York. In fact, if you go back to the media back then, you can find quotes where people say that's where it's how it's supposed to be because Asia's asset price is actually driven out of the West. Nowadays, it's a non-starter to have an investment team who's not based in the region. If you're not here, you're just not in the game anymore.
And what has that been like? I mean, you're an Asia-focused company. You also have been here for many years now. What are you noticing? Are you noticing more competitors coming in? Are you seeing more capital flowing to the region?
We're noticing a lot more competitors coming in. I think all of these larger global pot shops that you were mentioning earlier, 5 years ago, they were starting to have some substance in here. 10 years ago, most of them didn't even start in here. We were picking up a huge amount of interest from the alpha hunting community, both from the allocator side and from the hedge fund manager side, that recognizing Asia as having gone through this transition from a market where you only come when you think there's growth to, wow, even when growth is in question, it's still a bountiful alpha harvesting market.
Who's coming in? Like anyone in the past year that...
Everybody. Oh. Everybody. I don't want to name my competitors, but talk to your broker friends. At one point, I was told there were 50 pot shops hiring. I'm like, I cannot make that count. But a 50, lot of...
50.
I know. It's ridiculous, isn't it? I didn't know if I could believe the number, but I do hear, you know, so-and-so large pot shops are starting to hire one Asia person, two Asia person. The hurdle is very, very high. If you look at, I think, Goldman in their 2023 survey labeled global pot shops number at somewhere between 50 to 80 in that number. Most everyone wants to have Asia exposure, but the ones really have Asia's presence and can effectively compete in the hiring probably can count with a single hand. It's not for lack of demand, it's the lack of talent.
Jay, there's, you know, Katya and I had this discussion yesterday, and she was saying, like, why is it so hard to find really good fund managers? Like, there's a lot of smart people out there. There's probably a lot of people listening to the show that have had good returns on their stock market, their investment portfolio. Why is it so hard to get a good star manager?
You need to have some bit of mentorship, teaching you how to do this type of investment where it's largely skill-based. You try to filter away anything that you don't feel you have a strong edge on. You know, not market neutral, long short equity. What you do is you filter out the beta exposure to the market. Then you filter out the country exposure. Then you filter the sector exposure. You need a bit of mentorship. Then you need someone to be able to supply you that capital to try it out. In 2007, the only shop that was willing to give you this opportunity was a prop desk. That was gone. And then in the last few years, you have a lot more of these Asia's homegrown multi-strategy funds on one hand and these large global multi-strat on the other hand to continue to come in to provide that type of training. So the supply has increased significantly. The amount of talent available has increased significantly, but it's still not enough. There's still another 50 or probably more pod shops are waiting to set up shops in Asia.
So what do you look for then? Like, let's say someone's listening, they're in university right now or just starting their career. What are you looking for in the personality? Is it just returns? Is it the track record? What are you looking
for? What should they study? Like,
that too.
Like we interviewed someone and they mentioned that Jane Street doesn't hire people with business degrees. They hire people with like science and maths. Is that where it's going?
If I were to look at the career growth trajectory of a portfolio manager, most everyone typically you start from being an analyst. You know, this is where you learn from one of your mentors. By doing work he doesn't have time to do, manage a spreadsheet for him, do the corporate conference call for him. This is how you typically get to learn what the good portfolio manager actually does. Then your career progresses through, you become a senior analyst. Now you have ability to start pitching ideas. Now you learn something, now you try to apply to your own coverage universe. Through that process, you gain this knowledge into initially, typically, a selective number of stocks clustered around a sector around a country. That then allows you to have better insight than everyone else who's looking at the same thing. Mm-hmm. We call this the edge. That's what's driving your alpha. At some point, when you need a break, someone needs to give you this amount of capital to say, now you can try this portfolio manager on your own. And from that point, you start to have a track record. So every firm is, I guess, specialized at different part of this career progression of these portfolio talent. Some are in, I guess, analogous of a venture stage on training the talent fresh from school.
Right.
That requires a different skill set. Some firms in Asia are particularly good at it. We're not good at it. And some on the other end, I guess, more analogous to the kind of PE, you just go pay the big price to hire someone who's already extremely mature. That you say, I know you've made a lot of money elsewhere. Now I'm going to be $1 billion and please come to trade for me. We've seen examples like this in recent Asia history. And then what we have been particularly good at is to identify and work with these talent who have already figured out how to make money. So we're not very good at training people who doesn't know how to take risk, who does not know how to make money. But we're good at working with someone who have already learned how to make money from their previous mentors, but in need of a partner to scale up from being able to make $10 million to $20, $30, $50 million. That's what we focus on. Mm-hmm. So what do we look for? Because of where we focused on, the starting point is a track record. Despite the past performance is not an indicator for future, it is really the lacking of everything that's the best indicator. So we tend to start from there. Then we go a lot deeper, trying to understand what's the methodology behind the numbers, where the number come from. Can we reasonably conclude that taking you out of your previous team where you made that money to a brand new team where we tend to set you to be fully independent? You no longer have a CIO tell you, oh, you should cut here, you should double down there. No longer have that crutch. Can we still reasonably assure the alpha source you previously had that can be replicating here? That's where we make the bet. Where do they study? Honestly, we don't care particularly much. I've worked with portfolio managers who are English majors, who are philosophy majors, as well as science majors. It comes down to the individual themselves. It's not so much about what they learned in school. It's about everyone coming to field is already very smart and probably already worked very hard. Then there's a chunk of that, maybe 70, 80% of that. It's just you being passionate, you be focused, you be good at something, you be better at something than most everyone looking at the same thing. There's a bit of a, I call it almost a science part of it. If you're dedicated to it, you'll be able to get there. Then there's a some element, I call it 10%, 20%, almost like an art element of that. It's an art touch. To be able to consistently make money and still be able to manage it through a very tight drawdown framework. We don't particularly know how to identify that. I don't know, maybe have a debate. Some people say it's trainable, some people it's not. And that's where we rely on the track record.
That's great.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Asia Centric from Bloomberg Intelligence. I'm Katya Dmitrieva in Hong Kong.
I'm John Lee, also in Hong Kong. You can listen to all our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And this podcast was also produced and edited by Clara Chen. Thanks for listening.